So thank you so much. Thank you to Alessia and Mark for organizing this wonderful conference and for allowing me to chair this panel with very distinguished panelists. We are going to talk about puzzles in quantum gravity, and it's the turn of today of talking about black holes. So the first thing that I want to do is, of course, to introduce our speakers. First of all, we have Rob Myers, who is also the director of the Perimeter Institute. Thank you, Rob, for being with us for this panel. And then we have another local, I would say, that is Bob Holder, who is a professor at the University of Toronto. Then we have Ruth Gregory, I think chair of the department in at King's College now, and also a regular distinguished visitor here at Perimeter. Kelly Stelle is our next panelist, and who join us from Imperial College. And finally, the one who traveled the most to join us, that is Francesco Di Filippo from the Yukawa Institute in Japan. For today, we were asked, so I have here all our speakers, and the organizers gave us a number of ideas about things that are supposed to be puzzles in black hole physics and in the conundrum that connects black hole physics with quantum gravity. But before going into these questions, so when I was asked to chair this panel, my reaction was, well, yeah, we have a lot of puzzles in black hole physics, but there are so many things that we have understood. So I would like to start with a round of answers from you, saying what you would consider the greatest achievement in black hole physics. Of course, we know so many things from phenomenology, but we are theorists, and I would say also on the theoretical side, we have learned so many things. So there could be things that were supposed to be puzzles, and in your opinion, maybe they are not puzzles anymore, and we can build from them. So I would like to start with Rob, just quickly to go around and give your, you can be as provocative as you want or be very solid.
I'm gonna rephrase the question though. I thought, you know, what are recent developments that I'm excited about that where we've learned something, and I think that in my field, people are particularly excited about the, you know, their new calculations of the Page curve, which seem to be in a controlled context. And so it's showing that black hole physics is, or black hole evaporation would be unitary. And I think that's, you know, it's something that started with simple two-dimensional models. It was extended, you know, in various ways to ADS CFT, but I think, you know, various authors have also pushed it out to asymptotically flat context as well, and so that's one of the things that I thought was most exciting in recent years.
Great, that's a very good start for the conversation, for the discussions. So, Bob, you're next. Do you have a slide you want to show me?
No, well, I think, can I pass on this question?
So I'm going to be a bit more mundane, I think, than Rob. I think one of the things that I find the most amazing of, you know, the last decade of observations is the fact that, non-singular black holes notwithstanding, that the observations are largely bearing out general relativity, and the fact that this is the one area of physics where we have a piece of mathematics that corresponds precisely to what we are seeing in a physical system with very little compromise and mess almost everything else that we do when we make a physical model, we're always having to ignore various effects. Even quantum field theory, that's always done in some sort of perturbative expansion. And so for me, what made me really excited about the LIGO observations was the fact that it was telling us that this little thing that you can write down on a couple of lines is actually what is out there too, again, as far as we can tell. And so I guess that's what I find the most humbling in a way.
Yes, very nice. Thank you. Thank you, Ruth. And Kelly?
Well, I'm going to agree with everything Ruth just said, except that I would probably try to put it a little bit differently, in that I think, to me, the most striking thing is this whole subject has largely had its center of discussion depart from the domain of mathematical physics and into the domain of active early universe and other astrophysics. And we don't know how to make enough big black holes in the early universe and so forth. And those are the real topics now that you read in the New York Times Sunday magazine. And that's astounding that it's we've gotten to this stage. Of course, all the mathematical developments are also very interesting, but it's amazing that we are at this stage in the discussion.
Okay, and Francesco.
Yeah, I also completely agree. So, because the question was about which puzzle is now solved, and it's now part of the knowledge, accepting knowledge. And even though it's not exciting as the answer, I don't think we have one in the recent years, because the observations are in perfect agreement with what we expected, and I don't think this was a puzzle. But this is only regarding fundamental physics. I mean, we are learning a lot about astrophysics. We are learning a lot of things, so it's very exciting anyway. We are learning, for instance, that the black hole binaries, they exist and they are many, and that we can use them to learn about the universe. This is very exciting. But about fundamental physics, things that were unknown and then now we know for sure, I think it's a bit too early, because the observational waves and also electromagnetic counterpoint, it's a bit young, so we need to first explore more the theoretical side, and then we may be able to see some difference. But for now, it's amazing that we're in agreement with GR.
I think this is an amazing start, because I can see some convergence, but also some possible disagreement. I mean, when I formulated this question, for me, a possible answer would be coming from loop quantum gravity, for instance, a singularity resolution from the theoretical side is something on which we can be quite sure. But I would disagree with you about the page calculation. And I would put it in the other category, and that is this one. So the other part of the question, if on one end there could be some puzzles that have been solved, of course we have so many puzzles that are still there. And I wanted to start the conversation knowing from you what, in your opinion, is the most puzzling problem that we have. So. Rob, you are the first again to set the tone.
I'll go back to where I started, which is, how would we go about solving, seeing the page curve? I think a large fraction of the community thought, I'm going to have to get in there and understand the details of all of the black hole microstates and very complicated calculations, and it'll be UV physics and all of that. And somehow, the calculation that I talked about was a very simple calculation that, uses ideas from Euclidean path integral and things like that. And so one of the real puzzles remains is, well, how do you achieve that unitarity? If we believe it's unitary, we have these nice calculations, but we still don't really know the details of how that process is achieved.
Okay, thank you, Rob. And Bob?
I think one way to avoid the puzzles, the black holes, is to avoid black holes. So yeah. could I have that one first slide?
Yes.
I'd like to ask a question.
So which one?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
The question is, can a UV completion of gravity produce a black hole replacement? And another way to ask that question, are there states much larger than the small distance cutoff of an EFT that cannot be described by the EFT? Well, I think there's a QCD example of this. Quark matter stars cannot be described by the low energy effective field theory, in that case, the chiral Lagrangian. And that's basically because a quark star involves degrees of freedom of the UV complete theory, which is QCD. So quadratic gravity, another quantum field theory, might be a UV completion of gravity. And this theory has arbitrarily large, horizonless, classical solutions not present in Einstein gravity. So that's all for now.
Yeah, this is something that we can expand more than in the conversation. Thank you so much for bringing it into the discussion. And Ruth?
Well, I guess I have a sort of several puzzles. I was alluding to some of them this morning, but I think I'm going to go out on a limb and run the risk of being branded a heretic. I'm not sure whether, I certainly don't think that physics has to be unitary necessarily. I'm not sure I'm bothered by loss of information. We forget things all the time. And when someone dies, there's a lot of information that just disappears. So again, I'm a bit open-minded towards those standard puzzles. But I guess coming, now I've got to try and reset and try and think about black hole puzzles specifically. Coming back to some of the points I made this morning, I think I'm very ambivalent actually about Euclidean techniques and about the saddle point. Because, you know, thinking about problems in tunneling, whenever we do tunneling, we always sort of have this very idea, or at least we start off with an idealized Euclidean solution. And that certainly picks out the dominant contribution to an amplitude. But if you actually look at mock-ups of tunneling, because we're moving towards sort of, again, building things that simulate false vacua, it seems like our sort of theorists' calculations don't necessarily give a great approximation to the answers. And you know, if again you think about Schrödinger tunneling, you have not only an exponentially decaying tail, but also, you know, two parts of the wave function. And so somehow I feel that we're not capturing the full physics, I suppose. And again, applying that, I suppose, back to black holes, when we do black hole thermodynamics, again, it is a puzzle, because, you know, the intuition from the quantum interpretation of our black hole thermodynamics sort of indicates, for example, like the black string instability, entropy tells you a black string will be unstable, but it's a classical calculation to find the instability. And so it's this interplay between quantum intuition and classical results that I find puzzling.
I love this. I join you in wanting to know more about possible quantum instabilities, how they play into black hole existence. Kelly, what about you?
So this morning we had a very nice talk about the entanglement and information problems in black holes. And I mean, in a way, it was sort of the first time I was hearing that. I'd like to hear the extent to which all of those calculations can really be done to see if you end up with an answer zero at the end, but as a general idea. That's certainly one of the main, I think, the main puzzles. But the other one, which I guess all of us have been discussing, is the issue of singularities, is something that should be, one would like it to be solved in quantum gravity, whatever that is. It's interesting that it's not happening in the one version of quantum gravity that, well, I guess I'm sort of an outsider here in this community because I'm basically a string type person. But string theory isn't doing such a good job in resolving that issue. So to me, general relativity is an effective theory of something, hopefully in a fashion similar to the way pion theory is an effective theory of QCD. And but we don't quite know precisely what the underlying theory is. We have good candidates in string theory, but it's not doing the job properly for singularity. So is string theory itself an effective theory of something deeper? These are just open questions, and you asked about puzzles, so there are a bunch of puzzles for you.
Thank you. Francesco.
So first of all, let me say that I found very interesting that we are still disagreeing at some sort of what is a puzzle, when a puzzle is solved or not. So first of all, I would like to say, so what does it mean to solve a puzzle? And I think that there could be different answers to this question. One would be to find a mathematical consistent description. And in that case, I would say that the information loss puzzle will be solved. And there will be many solutions to that. Remnants are a solution that is a mathematically consistent description in which you have no information loss. And you were mentioning another one, which is very nice. But if we say that solving a puzzle means understanding what is nature doing, then I think that it's much more difficult to actually solve them, and even for the singularity. I agree with you about within the framework of loop quantum gravity, we can find a mathematically consistent description, and this is amazing. But we still need to understand whether or not this is happening in nature. So in this sense, I will put most of the question inside the unsolved puzzles. And so going forward, what I was trying to do during the talk and what I tried to do during the research is to, even though this is extremely difficult, I probably will never succeed to do that, try to do the bridge and to use the tools that we have to observe and to connect theory with observation. And so the singularity problem is maybe something that we will not manage to do that, but it's definitely something we have some hopes and we are trying to discuss this. And information loss paradox is similar, so.
Allow me to pick up what you are saying and react, because you are saying there is a nice mathematical framework, but then what is the physics behind this mathematical framework? And there is always a question whether we are guided by the mathematics or we are guided by ideas. It seems to me that the singularity resolution is something on which we have been for a very long time guided by a belief, a faith, that there should have been some singularity resolution, and then we made work in order to have the mathematics to confirm this intuition of us. So I think in all that we are doing with black holes, there is always this tension, how much we trust our mathematics, or shall we be guided by the intuition and then make the mathematics coherent with this physical intuition? I think this is a nice perspective that we can bring into some of the themes that have been emerging, because, for instance, one of a possible element that we can discuss further is the fact that in what Rob was mentioning, of course, there is the necessity to work with a Euclidean path integral. And then Ruth was putting some cautions there. And for all the techniques, we have to go into the Euclidean setting. We have to use saddle point techniques. So I think this could be possibly one thing that can be discussed further. I wonder if at this point you have a reaction yourself after all the answers that you have heard with respect to the first and the second question. How do you see yourself sitting and reacting to the others? So Rob, do you want to, shall we go around and have a first round of just reactions?
Reactions. I take Roos, you mentioned the Euclidean path integral. I mean, in some sense, that's a lesson. I mean, that's what we were learning from a certain perspective. You know, we were looking at various saddle points, and there was another one hanging around that we didn't know about or we didn't think of, and it's really, you know, that was the key to, well, what I see as the solution for solving for the page curve. But I you know, take your comments to heart. I mean, why is this working so well? Again, you know, we've solved this complicated question about microphysics, mm-hmm. but I didn't have to go into any of the guts of, you know, the microstates or any of that. And so we have this technique. It seems to give us nice answers, but, you know, why does it work so well?
Rob, since you are referring to results, but we didn't have a presentation or an actual elaboration, can you just say a few more words about exactly, I mean, you mentioned this at the beginning, but would you like maybe to give us a bit of elements?
Well, you know, usually the page curve's phrased in terms of entanglement entropy, but a tool that we often use is something called the Rainey entropy. So instead of taking logs of density matrix, you're taking squares or multiple powers. So if you take the trace squared of a of your reduced density matrix, that will tell you or it will lead to something called the second Rainey entropy, which is closely related to entanglement entropy. But you know, the kind of calculation that I'm thinking is, now I've got two copies of my system, and the standard calculations, the standard saddle points, were the ones that simply involved you know, solving the equations with one copy and then doubling it. The new idea was, well, there are other, you can find other saddle points that involve connections between the two copies. And that was the new saddle point, which seems to dominate mm-hmm. the calculation at late time. So that's the example, or an example, of the kind of thing.
And the final result is that the results of the page curve is confirmed.
That your entropy is decreasing at late stages in the process, yeah.
So it's something that is related to one of the questions that Francesco sent to me, because of course the information paradox is something that has been considered the holy grail of black hole physics from the theoretical point of view for a long time. But as Ruth was saying, maybe is less puzzling. Certainly there is a question of what we are exactly calculating there, because there could be different notions of entropy that we talk about, and very often we don't have a precise, so sometimes a lot of the confusion and of the puzzles in which we fall are just a difference in languages and difference in what we really, and imprecision, let's say, in what we mean by entropy. I don't know if people want to elaborate more on this, or any thoughts regarding the information loss or not known loss in case. Francesco, you were the one who was raising this to me. So
I think something that I would like to ask is regards the fact that I think it's kind of widely accepted that we need to solve the information, that the information needs to start leading out, like escape. We need to start recovering the information before entering Planckian regime, right? And I think this is widely accepted because there is we also make the assumption that for an outside observer, we have a limit of the number of degrees of freedom of the black hole, which is given by the area. And I understand that there are some arguments for that, but given that this principle alone leads to a contradiction between one of the pillars of general relativity, which is the equivalence principle, and the unitary evolution of a state, my question is, do we have enough evidence to stick with this assumption? Or what I mean is, it seems that we have a contradiction between three statements, and somehow we most people just assume the limit of the number of degrees of freedom and phrase the contradiction between the other two, which are pillars of the theoretical physics. So my question is, what is the biggest piece of evidence supporting this statement? So I'm not sure if the question is clear. Like why would it be so bad to start recovering information at Planckian scales? So which will contradict the fact that we have inside a black hole the number of degrees of freedom limited by the area? Which is,
sorry, why would that? Why do I think that would be a bad idea?
Why? Not you, right? But like.
I mean, it seems to me you're saying there's a puzzle there, and I mean, I guess my intuition is more leaning towards, well, I have this idea that there is a black hole entropy that's decreasing, mm-hmm. and so that becomes a contradiction then. I think what you might be saying is that's a coarse grain sort of quantity, and maybe if I knew the details of the microstates or the microphysics, the entropy would continue to rise. But I think the idea...
But probably I was not explained very well. I think my question is, if I trust semi-classical gravity up to the Planck regime, we get a contradiction with the Page curve, right?
Okay.
And but we also have good reason to trust the theory up to that regime, right?
Oh, okay, yeah.
So we also need a very good reason to say that this is a problem because we really want the Page curve. And so I was asking, what are these very good reasons?
Well, I think that was one of the remarkable things in many of these in these calculations. You are seeing deviations from the expected result, but you're meaning the sort of Hawking's result, but you're seeing that in a regime where you're well away from the Planck scale, and so it, you know, that's one of the reasons why I'm saying these, you know, we believe these are reliable calculations. If it all relied on, you know, something where I had to, you know, somehow I was reaching curvatures of the Planck scale, I agree that would be, well, that would make the calculation untrustworthy, or the calculations that we're doing untrustworthy, but that's simply avoided, or it's that's why, in some sense, it's a surprise that we could do these simple calculations mm-hmm. and get an answer like that.
I'm really curious to know if maybe Ruth or Teddy or...
Can I just address a point that Ruth made about the Euclidean path integral? one of the things that struck me, and I may make some a touch on this tomorrow, is that there are other ways to approach the path integral, and you don't have to have it purely real or purely Euclidean. You can do integration over complex metrics and complex matter fields too. And in particular, this is very useful, for example, in understanding the no-boundary proposal of Hartle and Hawking. And I should say, by the way, it's very sad we've lost both of them now, and there are too many good people missing in our subject. But, of course, Hartle and Hawking basically declared that a half of Euclidean de Sitter space, which has a nice hemisphere, can be glued onto a Minkowski signature, and they just propose that that's what we do. But you can actually have that come from an evolution over path integrals over complex metrics in a rather satisfying way, that you start out with basically a purely Euclidean time, and then as the evolution goes on, it settles down and into a Minkowski time. So there's a beginning of real time. And these sorts of ideas could perhaps be relevant also to your considerations about, you know, what's happening deep in a black hole, where the Euclidean path integral has sort of been declared by Cambridge Edict. And maybe one should look at it more generally. One of the things that happens, however, in this enlarged approach to path integrals is that there are not completely understood limitations on what you can integrate over, because the path integral should not diverge, and so you get new limitations by Koncevich and Siegel and Luco and others on which are the metrics that are allowable. And this also does interesting things, for example, in limiting parameters of theories. So there are things moving around in the dark out there that we need to understand better. And that was a partial response to your questions about the Euclidean path integral.
Yeah, I mean, I think to follow up on that, I think, you know, this what you just said about there are things moving in the dark that we would, you know, would do well to understand better. I agree, because, I mean, one of the things with, for example, taking the decay of the false vacuum, Coleman de Lucia, there are different ways in which you can wick rotate. You can choose different times to continue, and you know, some of them give you singular metrics, but again, if you integrate properly over them, you get exactly the same answer. So whilst I've expressed my concern that leading order is necessarily capturing the full information about a tunneling amplitude, nonetheless, you know, I think that there's a lot more than just T goes to I tau out there. So I think I'm in complete agreement with you that just looking more generally at complex continuations and different sections of these complex metrics, you know, is something that might actually give us a sort of slightly different perspective that might be helpful.
Just to dream a little bit, by the way, if we should.
We're allowed to dream.
Institute doesn't allow you to use your per diem to buy beer anymore, but never mind if one drinks something nice and dreams. I'm actually thinking about some nice talks that Sasha Migdal gave us in London on calculations in an infinite dimensional loop space, where he actually managed to get hydrodynamic equations out from a WKB approximation. But then, being Sasha Migdal with a background in computers, he says, actually, if you want to do the real calculation, this is a domain for quantum computers. And I'm just wondering now about whether one can get away from the saddle point approximations in the path integrals that we talk about to something more approaching a real calculation, which is too hard for anybody to do now, but can we actually take advantage of what the times we live in seem to be evolving towards? Anyway, that was my dream.
I cannot resist but jump into this conversation because indeed the loop quantum gravity one can define a Hartle-Hawking state that is fully Lorentzian. And one of the things that we are understanding is the role of the Euclidean geometry, even in that case, exactly for understanding tunneling. So there is a sense in which even if you are doing a Lorentzian path integral, Euclidean geometries comes and are necessary as degenerate states to account for a tunneling process. And this is connected with another issue that I wanted to bring to this panel. That is, the way in which these calculations have been used in loop quantum gravity are to address a calculation that bring a black hole into a white hole. So you can have a tunneling from black to white. And the reason why we do so is exactly because what I was saying before, that there is a strong sense that singularities are resolved, and therefore making this kind of calculations makes sense. And again, you can use different techniques, including the path integral ones. But the question for you now is, how the microphysics at the Planck scale emerges and influence your way to describe black holes? Where do you see a possible tension between these quantum effects? What I have in mind in asking this question is the fact that thinking that quantum physics resolve the singularity yields to macroscopic effects, for instance, also in terms of the physics of the horizon, or what will happen to information, because of course information can come out at a later time. So do you have other examples that are closer to your work in which you see really fluctuations of the geometry at the Planck scale that are relevant and give a phenomenology at a larger scale and changes the perspective on the information paradox or the physics or the horizon or other things. Or
I'm happy to start again.
Or I see Bob having
go.
Yeah, your question is right up my alley. That's almost the same question I asked. Mm-hmm. And I always go back to quadratic gravity because that's the thing I study. I'm not a black hole expert in any sense. So I have another slide.
Yes, I can find for you. Which one?
That one.
Oh, this one?
Either one.
You tell me.
Well, okay, let's do this one. As far as entropy, that's a big theme. And so, yeah, I have to go back to this. So I'm just using this theory as an example of how a UV complete theory can really change our perspective on all these questions. Okay. So what I call the solution is a 2-2 hole, and it's a gravitationally bound ball of relativistic gas, and its compactness is essentially the same as a black hole, which is really quite surprising because it has no horizon. It just comes out of the solution. And now we come to entropy here. Now, entropy here is not in any way a puzzle. You've got some gas. You know what the entropy density of that gas is. To get the total entropy, you just integrate over that. And you get a result. It has a kind of surprising property that along with the temperature at infinity, which also exists in this picture, that product is the same as the same product for a black hole, m over 2. But the individual quantities are not the same, so S22, the total entropy of the 2-2 hole, divided by the entropy of a black hole is not 1, and it has some expression I show there. It can be somewhat larger than one because that n is the number of particle species of nature. And because that's 120 or so, that can be, the result can be somewhat larger than one. So we have some object here that has a total entropy larger than a black hole, mm-hmm. possibly. So that's an interesting question right there. Is that compatible with everything else we know? But if I can just make one more point here, S22 is proportional to that number, to some power, and that does seem to avoid the so-called species problem of a black hole. The black hole does not depend on the number of species of nature, and that gives rise to some kind of puzzle. So, just another example. Okay.
Thank you. And
can I raise an issue about entropy? I'm not quite sure whether to put this in on the level of puzzles, because it could just be an error, but it's something at least that puzzled to me, because I don't understand it. There's the other type of entity in higher derivative gravity, not the 2-2 hole, but the one that actually is not Schwarzschild, but is still has a horizon and is a black hole. We calculated, using Bob Wald's formula for entropy, which involves the variation of the Lagrangian with respect to the curvature, and then you integrate that. So that's what we called entropy, at least. And then we calculated a free energy. And from that, and then, of course, my esteemed colleague right next to me is guilty of another thing here, which is the instability for the spherically symmetric instabilities of of strings, actually is replicated in this system in the Schwarzschild black hole, comes down as stable, 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 until it reaches a certain point called the Lichnerowitz point, found by Gross and Perry. And that's where the Schwarzschild black holes and the new black holes cross. And then the question is, what about, so the Schwarzschild black holes end their stable history when they reach that point, and below it they're unstable. That seems to be reasonably well understood by actually stability analysis, doing perturbative analysis, so quasi-normal modes and so forth. About the new black holes, not much is known, but if you look at the thermodynamic indications, you get one idea of where they should be stable, which is the old black holes, Schwarzschild reached this crossing point, and then for lower masses, it should have been the new black holes that are stable. But there's a calculation by Alan Held and Held and Zhang that says, no, that's the wrong way around. So this could just be my misunderstanding, their misunderstanding, or if could it be that there's something wrong with the calculation or the meaning of entropy for these higher derivative gravity theories? I just toss it out because I honestly don't understand what's going on here. There's supposed to be a clear link between thermodynamic stability and dynamical stability, as again, Hollands and Wald showed, and it's supposed to be an article in the Constitution, but there's a puzzle. This is a mathematical or technical puzzle rather than a grand puzzle.
But just so I can understand, you're saying the calculation says that the new black hole is...
The little ones smaller than this limit point should be the stable ones by the thermodynamic assessment.
Okay, but perturbative analysis...
says it's the other way around. So the ones
says the Schwarzschild is...
Yeah, they're the ones that are degenerate in mass with the Schwarzschild black hole. Of course, these are for the spherically symmetric instabilities, and there can be other ones as well. As soon as there's a lower mass black hole sitting underneath a Schwarzschild black hole, Schwarzschild should say, hey, I want to go there as well. Yeah. But so there's a technical puzzle, at least, about stability and thermodynamical versus thermodynamic stability, which I can't say anything more about. I just don't understand it.
So at a certain point, Bob, you had also a slide regarding singularity resolution. And this is a topic that I think it's very interesting for all of us. Do you want just to say a word? Maybe we can also then use your slide maybe to start.
Once again, if you have a UV complete theory, that does change your attitude towards singularities. Yeah. If you have a true continuum theory, you have, in some sense, a description of a singularity. And in this particular example of a two-hole, it has a time-like singularity instead of a space-like for a black hole. And so the theory I'm talking about that describes it is renormalizable and asymptotically free. So that means there's no unknown high-order curvature corrections that... That's right.
Yeah.
Typically for a black, or typically for any singularity, you're worried that we can't describe it because as you get closer and closer, then higher to higher terms in some action will come in. But that's not true for a true UV complete theory in this sense. Of course, there are diverging quantities, but integrals of those quantities can be finite, like the total entropy or the total energy of the gas. And one other thing is the implied boundary conditions, in this case, produce non-ambiguous wave evolution. So that's another case where it could have failed. And there are other types of singularities that produce ambiguous wave evolution. Okay?
And I would like to hear also from the other panelists your attitudes toward the singularities and infinities. As I said, my perspective is the one in which I have a strong physical sense that singularity should not be there. The mathematics of the theory I work always leads to some finiteness, the discreteness in the UV, but also there is a very strong sense that there is also a finiteness in the infrared with the presence of a cosmological constant and so on. So I would like to hear, so in fact, my original question was how the Planck scale comes in, quantum fluctuations come in what you do, but I am equally interested to hear your attitude towards infinities. So it should be, especially because when we work with the teleological quantities defined at infinity asymptotically, somehow you are assuming that infinities are a good thing that could be there. But in the moment in which you don't have infinities anymore, you treat infinities as some approximation, artifact of the mathematics, maybe your attitude changes. So any reaction? Ruth, maybe.
So I guess, I'm not sure, it may eventually loop around to this, but without actually knowing the details of some of the theories that have been mentioned here, one of the things that I suppose it's perhaps slightly directed more towards you, Rob, but if we are going to have this unitary evolution and information recovery, that presumably means that our black hole eventually disappears, and in some sense, therefore, by the strictest definition of an event horizon, it's not actually there,
yes,
because the definition is the boundary of the past of future infinity. So I guess I'm slightly puzzled as to how techniques that have two separate asymptotic regions are relevant if there is no second asymptotic region, because we don't actually have a real event horizon. We only ever have apparent horizons. So that's a puzzle that's hit me here. And for the singularity resolution, I guess sometimes, with that, that again is related into this sort of if our black hole evaporates, eventually it's going to get absolutely tiny. So how much does it really matter if we just have one point instantaneously where we don't have, we don't have, our Cauchy surface breaks down? I mean, again, I find I don't have a strong feeling. Yes, it would be nice to have a smooth resolution of a singularity, but I sometimes wonder, are we trying to be too greedy? Can we not survive just a little bit of unpredictability in our lives, I suppose?
So if I understand your position, you want somehow to be agnostic with respect to the internal singularity, because you are saying, since we have this strong indication that what happens to black hole is the evaporation, then you expect the evaporation to end into a point. Mm. And so who cares about what is inside?
I'm only just querying myself, that do we need to have absolute control over everything? That I guess that's what I'm, can we have a bit that, very small sets of unpredictabilities, but at the same time, I like control as well. So.
Certainly, we have to have control of the approximations that we are using, right?
Yeah.
So it's not a problem to have a control of everything, in the sense we always use approximations, but we need to know where they fail. Mm. And when it comes to the end of evaporation, on one hand, you have indications from general relativity that there is this very large interior that survives. So as the black hole forms, the interior starts growing and growing and growing. So that the evaporation process is much faster than the reabsorption, apparently, of this interior. And the other, when I was talking about discreteness and finiteness, indeed, there is also the idea that you cannot squeeze things to a point. So if you believe quantum gravity, both in the loop quantum gravity sense, but I believe that string theory is indicating something similar because of the string tension. Mm-hmm. So you probably cannot squeeze things to a point also there. So you should not expect that the end of evaporation is just a point. Mm. Do you?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess we haven't brought up discreteness yet in this discussion, but you're absolutely right, in the sense that we often, so many of the things we do, we assume continuity, analyticity, and again, should we be challenging some of those expectations? I don't have a good alternative, but yeah, I think, we haven't had much mention of
any
discreteness. I'll stop that.
Reaction to this?
I think I agree with you when you say that, okay, from outside, this is very small. From the inside, this is definitely not small. And of course, it depends. I think we can live with uncertainty, but it would be nice also to understand. But in principle, there is nothing wrong. But this, what I really wanted to say is that something that you said, reconnects to what we were saying before about whether or not the information, the solution to the paradox should be something in the UV or in the AR physics. Mm. And given that I agree with you that there is this dependence of what is going to happen at the end of the evaporation, whether or not we are going to recover the information, because if we have a truly event horizon, and hence we also have a Cauchy horizon, and if we completely evaporate a black hole, then I would expect that we will lose the information. I mean, I will not have any reason to expect that we should recover the information, because if we cut away some part of the manifold, the information which was there, it's going to be lost, and it was going to be fine for me. So what is, instead, if we have something that resolves the singularity and everything is eventually goes out, then I would expect that we also will recover the information. But this is a clear UV question, depends on the physics at the singularity. So it's kind of puzzling to me that there are many resolutions of the problem that do not take into account the physics of the singularity. Of course, does not mean that this cannot happen. It's just a personal intuition. The way I think about the problem.
You want to react, please? Time is flying. This is wonderful. A lot of things to talk about. And I wanted to leave time also to the audience to pose questions. But I cannot resist. There is one topic that I feel, for which I share a passion. Ruth, you worked on this. And I have heard from Kelly at the beginning that he also seems to like this topic. That is the one of primordial black holes. Because as Ruth was saying in the beginning, we are learning a lot of things with the physics of gravitational waves detectors. And in particular, we have learned that there are black holes in sizes that we were not expecting. And in particular, some of these black holes may be below the solar mass. So this is a very strong hint that they can be primordial. And this is, finally, we quantum gravity theorists can have something to say on this large-scale physics and maybe say something to our colleagues working in gravitational wave and doing detections. So I would like to have a few words from you, Ruth, to start with, regarding your work and how you see the interface also between quantum gravity, black holes, and cosmology, because this is the gluing subject, somehow the bridge between black holes and quantum gravity in this case.
So you've really put me on the spot there. So the work I think you're referring to was the matter stability of the vacuum and the possible impact of black holes. So I think it's only fair to point out that that's, as I've said, you know, I'm cautious about using some of the Euclidean approaches. And I think there's a lot of interesting physics still to be probed in that effect. But what this is just referring to is the fact that when we look at a vacuum metastability, the phase transition is usually first order. It proceeds by bubble nucleation, whereas most phase transitions in nature, first order phase transitions, tend to be catalyzed by seeds rather than just sort of occurring in some supercooled state. And a black hole is a very simple seed, and it keeps the symmetry of the problem sufficiently preserved. It breaks a little bit, but not too much, so you can still largely calculate by hand. And it seems that the black holes change or enhance the tunneling amplitude. So again, I think this just, you know, this kind of gives you a new spin on trying to think a bit differently about processes when you start including gravitation in processes that you might imagine are more obviously field theoretic. There's, again, you know, a lot of queries about possible effects of the, you know, of the thermal background, but of course a black hole isn't in a thermal equilibrium. This is why I've sort of been umming and ahhing mm-hmm. about Euclideanization. But it's, to me, what I find fascinating about it is it's sort of bringing in very, what are normally quite distinct branches of physics, sort yeah. of, you know, particle phenomenology versus early universe physics. And I think one of the surprises that I had when I was looking a little bit at black holes, at primordial black holes, is about their formation and how it seemed like, you know, our models for forming primordial black holes are sort of still quite provisional. You know, it looks like there's a lot to be done there. And again, I think this is incredibly fertile ground for thinking about both sort of classic cosmology, but also if you want to think about possible observational signatures or testing your favorite theory of quantum gravity, if you know how to apply it to a small black hole, I think that's incredibly fertile ground.
Kelly, you were mentioning small black holes at the very beginning, so do you want to say something regarding this?
I mean, my involvement with black holes is mainly the course I teach at Imperial, but also this is what I just referred to about the higher derivative gravities of other black holes. I can comment not so much in connection with black holes, but on cosmology. Another activity I have has been largely with Jean-Luc Lenners, trying to understand, either with the higher derivatives or without, what one can learn, for example, from these more general path integrals, and whether there are implications from this basically quantum gravity structure, for example, the curvature squared terms, can shed light on, for example, on the Weyl curvature, Penrose's Weyl curvature hypothesis, that if you demand again, that the path integral not diverge, that you come to the conclusion that both the inhomogeneities and the anisotropies should vanish at the south pole of the early universe, Euclidean early universe. And I find that it's fascinating that you that the terms that you only bring in because of renormalization problems in the standard approach to quantum gravity then start to have implications for the very early universe. So there is a possible fertile interplay between these two subjects, and that is something that seems to be happening now.
No, I was just thinking. You know, Kelly pointed us to the most interesting singularity. I think we were thinking of black holes, but if we look back far enough, that's the one we should be thinking or could be thinking about. Maybe black holes are a test ground to try and gain some intuition. But, you know, with gravitational waves, and we can see further and further back into the early universe. And so, you know, maybe there is fertile ground there, not just for theorizing, but for observation as well.
Yeah, certainly things are connected in the sense that we have started to learn about the thermodynamical aspects of the gravitational fields thanks to the puzzles posed by black holes. And we are understanding entanglement entropy in this setting. But of course, entanglement entropy is essential to understand the primordial states of the universe and understands primordial quantum fluctuations. So here is how this conversation connects with the wider one. I wanted to open at this point the conversation and open to questions to the public. We have discussed so many different things, each of them would require an entire panel just for one question. So, I don't know if you wanted to add different topics or just ask to our panelists to dig more into some of these questions.
Thank you. I had a question concerning the page curve in string theory and how this is resembled. So In a paper by Maldathena, it is written that you have the quantum extremal surface and you cut out something from the interior of the black hole, and this would tunnel into a different black hole. So you would have a swapping of interiors of black holes. So I guess this is more in picturesque picture of what is actually happening. Can you give an idea of what actually could happen in our universe? How this purification then works?
Let me answer another question. I'm not exactly sure which construction you were referring to, but you know, we were talking to quantum effects on the horizon, and Bob was talking about extended objects or new kinds of objects. Kelly was as well. But you know, string theory, well, there's the whole program started by Samir Mathur, and you know, there are questions about that, whether they're enough states. But I'd also point to an interesting paper that came out in the middle of a pandemic that Patrick Hayden and Jeff Pennington wrote that I think isn't being given enough attention, but they argued with their, I'll call it their quantum information intuition, or you know, making connections to various theorems in quantum information, that you know, black holes should have some kind of structure. If I'm thinking not about a black hole that's formed in some kind of complicated process of collapse, but I'm thinking about a pure state, an object that an individual quantum state of a given mass, that should have structure at the size of the black hole. And I think these ideas are out there, and I think we're inevitably being drawn in that direction. And so whether it's some kind of complicated story in string theory or Bob's story with higher curvature terms, I think that's something that we should be seriously thinking about, or more seriously thinking about more broadly. And so I'm sorry I evaded your question, but I got to get something off my chest.
Thank you.
Ask a follow-up question.
Sure.
In your examples, would they give rise to gravitational wave echoes?
Certainly, people are investigating that. There isn't a very clear consensus, but that's certainly something that's, I know, very interesting, or of interest to Samir and the...
I saw... Okay, Renate first, then?
I wanted to comment about, well, the topic of Euclidean methods again, and the Euclidean path integral, which of course comes up in part of the black hole story. So I share Ruth's wariness about these methods in general. Of course, there can be a tool, but I would be very, I would be wary if a particular argument needs them to give them a more fundamental status. And then we are coming, of course, kind of to the Euclidean path integral. Yeah, so my background is a different type of reality check, right? Ruth comes from looking at analog models. I would say mine comes from looking at non-perturbative formulations. So what is the perspective one sees there? Well, the perspective is just a confirmation of why people put aside the Euclidean path integral at the end of the 80s, was to say, this is so sick as a quantity, it's just so ill-defined in four dimensions, of course, for full quantum gravity. Not, I'm not talking cosmology. So let's put this aside, let's look at something different. And from the non-perturbative standpoint, this can be absolutely confirmed. So of course you have the conformal divergence, and which renders all arguments about, the saddle points mute, because they're just not there. You know, you fall off the abyss. So there is, so one has to be careful there. Of course, what we found from the point of view you know, of lattice quantum gravity after a lot of false trials. There's one way of resolving it, which is really taking the Lorentzian structure seriously, formulating, you know, the non-perturbative, purely gravitational path integral in that structure, you know, rotating it, doing the computations there, and then you find there's a stable ground state. It has nothing obvious to do with any subtle points that people talk about. Yeah. So that throws then some, maybe question marks on, how seriously should we take manipulations that we do within quantum cosmology, within reduced models, within low-dimensional models, of course, where, for instance, you don't have the conformal factor problem. So that's a question. It doesn't mean, I would say, that Euclidean features like what we see in thermodynamics, black hole thermodynamics, they don't capture physical aspects we are interested in, but one should maybe be rather careful in, you know, giving them to more than, you know, this is a tool, you know, of capturing certain properties, which are, of course, properties of the Lorentzian theory, and one should be careful.
Reaction.
So I think just coming back to this idea of the tool, when you think about black hole temperature, for example, when you rotate to Euclidean time and say what is the periodicity that makes the horizon regular, that is, I always regard that as a shortcut. It's the simplest way to find out the black hole temperature, but we know that there are Lorentzian methods to get the same answer. And so I guess then what I would like is equivalent sort of Lorentzian methods to get the false vacuum decay, if you like, from a Lorentzian perspective, both with and without gravity. So, you know, I know that there are thoughts. I know Matt Johnson here is working on sort of a truncated Wigner type of approach, but to some extent, I sometimes feel that is introducing some energy into the system. So I suppose that could be rephrased as a renormalization question. But I think we still sort of lack, if you like, a real-time description for some of the things that Euclidean approach is very convenient for.
But you're always talking about what I would call truncated models. It's not the full theory, right? When I talk about tunneling, etc., it would always be in a cosmological model. So what I'm saying is there are intrinsic problems if you want to extend whatever argument you have, you know, walking around in the complex planes that you apply in your cosmological or simplified models, for instance, two-dimensional models. They have, unfortunately, they tend just not to generalize, you know, in any meaningful way to the full theory. So that's, I think it's a general lesson, what, you know, everything we've learned over the last 40, 50 years conforms with that.
I wonder if any, or Rob or Kelly wants to comment on this. Do you, I have maybe a way to also ask questions on this, like, do you see the contribution from a Euclidean phase as something physical or an artifact of our mathematics?
I just wanted to, I'm not sure I'm addressing what you're bringing up, but there's another dream, which I don't know exactly what to make of, but I treat general relativity as an effective theory of something. And we have other effective theories where we have better understanding of the relation between the effective theory and the microphysics underneath, i.e. The standard model, QCD. And are there things that we should be thinking about or remembering from the epoch of Murray Gell-Mann, who actually saw an amazing amount of stuff with which turned out to fit precisely with the underlying physics, in pion physics, for example. And there are a couple of hints at the pion physics level, taking that as a model for general relativity, there are a couple of hints of what has to be going on down below. For example, that is the Atoft anomaly matching condition. There's also the general structure of the way nonlinear realizations are represented in the chiral symmetry. In order to do it the way Callan Colan, Vesin Zumino, Chris Isham, and others actually gave the general theory of nonlinear realizations, you have to, out of the blue, invent a thing that looks awfully like gamma 5, which is what? There are no spinners in here, but it fits together in a beautiful way. Is there anything like that that we should be noticing, or, again, drinking some good beer or wine and dreaming up, that's going on in general relativity and the phenomenology we have about it, that are clear hints? Without preconceptions, of course, I tend to look towards string theory, but are there ways that one can try to pin down features of general relativity that are hints of what's going on down below? Actually, Astrid, in a very nice talk, gave an unfortunate answer to that, that there tends to be a washing out of information of the very very highest energies when you get down to the effective theory of asymptotically safe gravity. But maybe not everything is washed out. So that's just, there are two types of talking about physics. One is with coffee in the morning, and the other is with a good glass of alcohol in the evening. And this is more tending towards the latter.
Well, I think Ruth was pointing us to, you know, places where you expect things to break down for GR, you know, the final stages of the black hole, or I don't know, I think you were alluding to your black string pinching off. You know, those are places where there's uncertainty or there's opportunity perhaps to get a glimpse into some UV structure or beyond GR.
Luca.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have really a point related to this. No, I don't really have a point about what Kelly said. I have actually a question regarding higher derivative curvature, and especially for Bob Holdom. And first of all, I completely agree that most likely we should expect from this higher curvature, we should expect like some UV resolution of singularities. But at the same time, if I understand well your solution and your replacement of black hole in terms of this 2-2 hole, you are expecting also that higher curvature should be somehow effective also at the horizon scale. So for instance, if I have a very large, massive compact object, you would expect this higher curvature to play a relevant role also at very large scales. Otherwise, you could not basically replace this horizon. So from my perspective, it's very difficult just working with this higher curvature gravity to see strong effects at the horizon scale for very large compact object. So can you please comment a bit more there? Why would you expect this higher order curvature to play a relevant role even on large scales?
Well, I gave that example of quark matter star. In that example, QCD effects are playing a role throughout that whole, whatever volume that is. Right? And so right at the edge of the quark star, those heavy modes, the QCD modes, will die away exponentially. So I think that's a very good analogy to what I'm talking about for the 2-2 hole. It is very surprising that the dynamics of the theory, which is on a certain scale, can extend over these huge distances. And all I can say is we've seen that example in QCD, and then numerically, we can look at these same kind of things in this this quadratic gravity theory.
But do you see only that you have extra solutions, but you still can admit black holes as other possible solutions? I mean, you are not really excluding the existence of black holes in that theory, right? You're just adding some new solution. So it could be that maybe for very small objects, this type of 2-2 hole could really form, but maybe if you are considering like some large compact object, horizon can still form somehow. So it could be that just some dynamical process at some point could maybe turn a black hole to some...
I'm kind of losing... Just maybe speak a little slower.
Yeah, sorry. I'm saying that... So it's true that you are finding these two-hole solutions, but at the same time, you are not excluding possible black hole solutions.
Also the what solutions?
Black hole solution. You are not excluding black hole solutions from your theory.
I'm not excluding the black hole solution.
Yes.
That's right. So you have a choice. Both solutions are in the theory. Let's suppose historically this happened, that both solutions were discovered at the same time, and the Schwarzschild solution was not known before that, right? What would people have thought? They saw those two solutions. Which one makes the most sense?
Or you could just have both. I mean, in principle.
If you have both, we have to decide. One of them might be just an artifact, not physical at all.
Yes, please.
Thank you. I have a general question for the panelists. It is generally, when we have constraints from the gravitational wave side and constraints from the black hole image side, they seem to be sort of incompatible because they are not looking at the same masses for the black holes. So my question would be, do you see a way to reconcile both sides and try to match constraints from gravitational waves and black hole imaging?
So the two scales you have in mind, we couldn't hear very well from here. Can you repeat?
My question would be, usually the constraints coming from the gravitational wave side do not really match those from the black hole imaging side. And I was just asking, would you see a way to reconcile those constraints?
So the question is about the constraints that comes from gravitational waves. I don't know if you have any specific measurements in mind, but of course we have all the data about black hole merging, we have data about the speed of gravitons, the speed of gravity, and so on. And on the other hand, you're saying the general constraints from what we know about black holes. And can you elaborate? Why do you think that, what are the point of tensions between these constraints?
Because you would expect that if your black holes are smaller, have a smaller mass, then the potential alternatives to GR black holes would be seen in the gravitational wave signals.
Yeah, I was just going to mention the speed of gravity is clearly related to that question. Right? Is the speed of gravity the speed of light? So far the answer is yes, but that's maybe something where observations are going to get better and better.
I'm not sure I understood exactly. So there are this disagreement between constraints. I couldn't hear very well. Because from here, it's very...
I think the question is regarding on one hand the gravitational waves and the physics of black holes evaporation in particular. I don't know if others have more insights on this. Otherwise, we have only 10 minutes to go. So I hope we can also elaborate more on this for during the coffee break. But let's go to the next question.
Excuse me. There are a lot of questions online, but let me make a selection. So a brief question, is it maybe possible that an evaporating black hole will turn back into a neutron star or something like that?
I'm sorry, I just can't make out what is being
said. Yeah, you have to speak always very, very close to the microphone. Yeah,
just
and slowly.
Slow down the words. That doesn't mean say the word equally quickly and have a space in between. Just slower words.
It's possible from black holes to neutron stars.
Is it possible that evaporating black holes turn back into a neutron star?
Good, interesting.
Why do you?
When they get
so why not? Or
is it possible? That's the question.
I don't know. But one thing that I've always found quite interesting is we're going back, I guess, three or so decades, if you think about solutions for that have some sort of topological aspect, like monopoles, you don't necessarily just have vacuum outside a black hole, that you also have some aspect of the field. So you have part of your, if you like, Tov-Polyakov profile outside the black hole. And so whereas, you know, one's instinctive reaction would be to say, no, it's not going to come outside because of the usual arguments, I guess, of causality. At the same time, it is true that for soliton-type solutions, that these can reappear outside of horizons. And so I think that, you know, that is quite an intriguing question.
Yeah, I don't know if you were thinking in terms of of the effects due to the atmosphere, or rather the fact that in the moment in which the horizon shrinks, it may meet again the star in the interior.
The star in the interior
can come up somehow, but you need maybe a white hole.
It's an online question, so I don't know.
Okay.
I guess that it's possible that the trapped surface disappears, and I don't think likely that you will get a neutron star, but maybe something more exotic in principle, yes.
Yeah, and there is the general question you have been working on, that is, if you have an external horizon and an internal horizon, what happens if they meet?
Yeah.
So
you require a way for the no-hair theorems to break down at some point, which certainly is imaginable, but that does require something beyond straight
something
general
interesting,
relativity.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, hello. I think that I just wanted to make a comment and see your reaction, that I feel you guys are very pessimistic about the future. I don't know. there is
primordial black holes.
Well, it could be primordial black holes, but the point is, yes, GR has worked very well, but it's going to fail at some point, and just saying that our stories seem to fit together and seem to kind of confirm our confirmation biases, that doesn't mean that's the way it's going to go, because, I mean, our stories have been semi-classical. And I think actually I can maybe shed some light at the question that was asked about, like, big black holes and small black holes. And yes, there are very different kinds of black holes. And if you have effects that are suppressed by some power of entropy, or worse, exponential of entropy, then of course you don't expect to see any effect beyond GR for any black hole that you see. But if there are effects that are suppressed by log of entropy, then log of entropy is essentially the same for big black holes and small black holes. And it's not very big, it's like 100 to 200. And they're very achievable, percent level effects. These are things we can look for. And this is the kind of thing that comes from arguments for echoes that, for example, Bob has worked on, and me and others. And this is a time scale for a scrambling that from quantum information arguments have come about. So I think there is a lot of back and forth about echoes and what can be observable, but I think there is a clear direction where you don't have to fudge things and fine-tune things, but there could be something to see. And these are effects that log suppressed, so they're not very small, maybe percent level effect. And they should be there for all types of black holes that you could see in nature. Just we have to see them a little bit better than we are doing right now. So I think there's cause for optimism, maybe, for younger people out there. There could be new things to see that are not far-fetched and pie in the sky.
Yeah, does anybody maybe... Bob, do you want to react?
I completely agree.
Yeah, I also don't think I'm pessimistic about the future. And I do think, though, that we really should know what we are looking for, because, like, it's not just confirmation bias. It's that, for instance, we don't have template of waveform beyond general relativity, right? So it's still early, but, like, I don't think it's impossible to see some deviation. Also for echoes. I think at this stage it's still a little bit too oversimplified the theoretical analysis, but like there could be some deviation in the waveform. Just we need to work for. We need to work from the theoretical side. There's still much work to do.
As Bob Dylan said, the times are changing. But my own view on this is not pessimistic, but more. I think there's a shift in focus taking place. Actually, more towards observation and what we learn from observation. There's so much happening now, especially in early universe cosmology and large-scale structure, that we don't know what we're going to learn from that. And I think, actually, my attitude towards particle physics is also the same. It's strange for somebody who's played with mathematical stuff all my career, but actually, one has to look carefully at the various funny anomalies which are showing up, not exactly where we thought they might show up, but they are. Something's happening. And we need to just learn how to pay attention to that.
One last quick question.
I would like you to make a prediction. So when and where will we see deviations from GR black holes?
Okay, this is a wonderful question to close this panel. So I will go to all of you and ask you to answer this question very quickly. You are always the first, Rob.
Yeah, so we should change it up.
Okay, the youngest this time.
I don't think I can make a prediction. I don't know.
What's your favorite window?
I don't know. It's too... I don't know. Like, no idea. I'm sorry, but...
Okay, I answer for you. Maybe an internal horizon? No? No? Okay. Kelly.
Well, look, if we come back to this pion physics versus QCD dream that I had hoping for something in gravity, there is, of course, a limit there where the pions start to dissolve and you start to see that there is the underlying structure. So my answer, that's where you start to see beyond general relativity, is there, where you start to see what is actually going on. We don't have governments who are paying enough for our experiments right now to see that, but that's in principle where it happens.
Okay, I'm going to just stick a pin. I'm going to say Lisa's daughter, in the sense that when we can get our gravitational wave observations down, down to being, you know, really clean of noise. So that's what I'm going to vote for.
So you're thinking that at the level of the black hole merging, maybe there could be already...
To start to actually get more confidence and more definition, yeah. So it's just, as I say, it's a bit like just guesswork, yeah. But I'll go with Lisa's daughter.
Good. Mm.
I say LIGO will discover gravitational wave echoes within 10 years, especially if data experts can come and look at that data. I've looked at that data enough to know it's ugly data. There's a lot of stuff in there. But you need, if that's looked at carefully, and actually looked not just at very simple models of echoes, but a more general type of approach, yes.
Wonderful. And Rob.
I'm gonna echo what Niash said. Is there are a lot of young people out there, and we need new ideas on new kinds of effects. But I think I'm actually disappointed in Ruth. You know, there are a lot of great observations that are going to take place in the sky. But there's also a new adventure starting in the lab with, mm-hmm. Analog simulators or quantum simulators. I'm not sure what we're going to discover there.
So I think one of the problems, though, there is people always criticize that as being, it's only ever being analogous to gravity.
Yeah.
So I think it could give us some insights. But I think we will have. There's always a real uphill battle in convincing people that it's telling you something about quantum gravity. So sorry to have disappointed you, but I mean, I think some of the things that we're involved in are going to be really quite fun. But I think we'll have a lot of trouble convincing people that it tells us about
about? Well, it may not be quantum gravity, it may not be black holes, but I agree. I think there's opportunities to learn new things, and yeah, we should be optimistic. There are a lot of exciting things happening.
And there is always the possibility that quantum gravity is just in front of our nose, and we need just to change perspective. So if there are primordial black holes, or if dark matter is made of remnants and so on, maybe the data are already there. It's just us that needs to put different glasses. So this has been a wonderful conversation. I want to thank again all our distinguished panelists, Rob Myers, Bob Holden, Ruth Gregory, and Calistelle, and Francesco Di Filippo. Thank you so much.